This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky, February 2012. Well, the evening sky in February presents perhaps one of the most beautiful skyscapes that we have. Centre stage, of course, is the constellation of Orion, with its bright stars Betelgeuse to the upper left and Rigel down to the lower right. Below the central star of the three stars that make up its belt is the Sword of Orion, which contains M42, the Orion Nebula. And even with binoculars, you can see that there's a little hazy glow, so do have a look for that. Down to the lower left of those three stars, if you follow them down, you come to the brightest star in the northern hemisphere, Sirius. Fairly low at times, and the effects of the atmosphere causes it to twinkle, and also you get little shafts of colour, the refraction in the atmosphere, and we sometimes get rung up saying we've seen this UFO in the south. Going up to the right from those three stars, you come first to Taurus the Bull, and the red star Aldebaran, which is the eye of the bull, is actually halfway between ourselves and the Hyades cluster that makes a sort of a V, which you can imagine as the head of the bull. Carrying on a bit further, you come to that lovely cluster of stars called the Pleiades, sometimes called the Seven Sisters, although in my view you either see five or perhaps you see nine, and perhaps the other two are mum and dad. Up to the left of Orion are the heavenly twins, Castor and Pollux in Gemini. And then going up to the right towards the zenith, you've got our Auriga with its bright star Capella. The Milky Way runs along the base of the twins up through Auriga, and there are quite a number of nice little open clusters of stars that one can see there. As the evening draws on, Leo the Lion is rising over in the east. Below that, of course, as we shall see, is the planet Mars. So a lovely area of sky to look at. Well, let's have a look at the planets this month. And we've actually got pretty well every one that one can normally see. Jupiter, although it's perhaps just a bit past its best, is still beautifully seen in the evening sky. It transits due south about half an hour after sunset at the beginning of February. In fact, on the 1st of February, it'll be 50 degrees above the southern horizon, really nice and high, shining at magnitude minus 2.4. It's in Aries, very close to its boundary with Pisces. The angular size is still 38.7 arc seconds, and that actually means that a small telescope will easily show the equatorial bands. There's some little dark markings in the northern one. They're called barges. And you may see what's called the Great Red Spot, but to me, it looks a rather pale yellow-orange. And one of the highlights that you find in the night sky page is where I list the times and the dates when the Great Red Spot is transiting, basically directly facing us, so you can have a good chance to find it. Well, what about Saturn? Well, it's becoming more prominent. At the beginning of the month, it rises at midnight and can be seen due south at about 5:30 a.m. before dawn. But in contrast to Jupiter, its elevation then will only be 31 degrees. And the problem is, whereas Jupiter is getting to the top or the highest part of the ecliptic in declination, so it's high in the sky when we see it south, Saturn is, I'm afraid, moving towards the lowest part of the ecliptic, so it will not be so high. Its magnitude plus 0.6, increasing somewhat to 0.5 during the month. One nice thing, however, is that the rings are now opening out. At its last apparition, they were basically sort of edge-on to us, so you couldn't see them very well. They're now about 15 degrees to the line of sight, and therefore, if you do have a fairly steady night when what's called the seeing is good, you should easily see what is called Cassini's division between two of the rings, and you may just pick out what's called Encke's division in the outer ring, and also a rather elusive C, or perhaps crepe ring, which lies between the brighter rings and the planet's surface. It's a lovely thing to see, and that'll be coming better and better in the next few months. Mercury actually passes behind the Sun on February the 6th. That's called superior conjunction, so we're not going to see it for a bit, but it does appear in the sky towards the very end of the month in the southwest after sunset at magnitude minus 1.1. It's actually moving towards us quite quickly, so the angular size of about 6 arc seconds is increasing. And I'll come back to Mercury in one of the highlights. Well, two to go. Mars. Well, Mars, as I said, is below Leo, and it's actually now moving retrograde. That means it's sort of moving westwards in the sky rather than eastwards. I just happened to pick up Russell Grant doing some astrology on Radio 2, I think it was, the other day. And he kept on telling people not to make any decisions because Mars was their planet and it was moving retrograde. I'm not totally convinced I believe that. Anyway, by the month's end, it rises at about 6 p.m. and will have an elevation of 50 degrees below the lion's hindquarters later that night. The angular size is getting bigger, up to 14 arc seconds by the end of the month. And that means you can now, with a small telescope, see features on its salmon pink disk. The most obvious feature is the V-shape of Syrtis Major and the North Polar Cap, which is now tilted towards us. So that's going to be a prime planet to observe next month and the month after. And finally, Venus. You may well have spotted Venus in the southwestern sky after sunset. It's gradually increasing its angular separation from the Sun. On the 1st of February, it's 39 degrees away, and that means it will have an elevation of about 30 degrees at sunset, and it's certainly becoming much more obvious than it has been. It continues to draw away from the Sun, so by the end of the month, it's 44 degrees away at angle, and it will be a further 7 degrees higher above the horizon. So really, after sunset, if it's clear, you really cannot miss it. As it gets bigger, because it's getting closer to us, the angular size goes from 15 to 18 arc seconds. At the same time, the percentage that's illuminated that we see is falling from about 74 to 64%. And that means the brightness stays remarkably constant at about magnitude minus 4.1 throughout the month. So quite a lot to see, and that's every one of the planets that we normally talk about visible at least at some point during the month. Well, there aren't a lot of great highlights, I have to say, in February. There aren't any nice meteor showers, for example. But perhaps at the beginning and the end, there are two quite nice things to see. Rising in the east before dawn, say at about 6:30 a.m., you will see the bright star Vega in the constellation of Laro. If you move up and a little to the west, that's to the right towards the south, you will see the constellation of Hercules, whose four brightest stars make up the keystone. Now, as it rises, we actually see it on its side. So the top of the keystone is up to the left. If you look with binoculars above the line joining the two bright stars at the top, as we see it, to the upper right, shall we say, you should pick out, about two-thirds of the way from the rightmost up to the left, the globular cluster M13. These are spherical balls of stars, perhaps a million stars, very old, almost micro-galaxies that were formed at about the time our own galaxy was formed. It's the best that we see in the Northern Hemisphere. To the left of the keystone, when seen at this angle, is another globular cluster called M92. It's half a magnitude fainter at 6.5 as opposed to magnitude 6. And it gets a bit overlooked because it's pretty close to M13. The reason I mention these two is that during February, running quite close to M92, and at its closest on the 3rd of February, is Comet Garrad. And the Earth is actually moving towards it at the moment, and its magnitude is expected to be about magnitude 7 this month. So although you won't see it with your unaided eye, you should easily pick it up with binoculars. As I said, on February the 3rd, you should see it quite close to the globular cluster M92. It reminds me of a day way back in 1990. It was August the 19th. I was camping in the south of France with my family. It was a lovely clear night, and I was showing some of the other campers what we could see in the sky. And Pegasus was fairly high up. Now, just above the head of Pegasus, the winged horse, is another globular cluster called M15. And I suggested to the people who were with me that we might actually have a look at that. And I put my binoculars on it, and I was amazed to see how bright it was and how clear. Well, of course, we were in southern Brittany. The skies were very dark. It was higher up in the sky than we see it from northern England, where I live. So I thought perhaps that was the reason. But it wasn't until I got home that I saw a lovely picture of Comet Levy at about magnitude 3, just within a cat's whisker of the globular cluster M15. So in fact, I'd shown them a comet, but just didn't know what it was. Well, on February the 9th, at about 9 p.m. in the evening, I mentioned Mars lying beneath Leo. Well, there's in fact a moon just 2 days after full, very close to it. So a nice little sort of grouping there of the moon and Mars. On February the 12th, before dawn, Saturn is visible with Spica and a waning moon, making a virtually straight line in the sky. So if you get up early, another nice thing to see. But perhaps the best thing to see is on February the 25th, because then, in the evening sky, we will have Jupiter, Venus and Mercury, along with a thin crescent moon. Mercury is quite low down, so you may have a problem seeing that. But even so, Venus very close to the moon and Jupiter up to the left should look very nice. And when you're actually looking at a very new moon, see if you can spot the Earth shine, sometimes called the old moon in the new moon's arms. That's a nice thing to see. In the night sky page, I've been trying to indicate one thing you might look at in the moon each month. And this month I chose the Hyginus Rill. At the centre is a crater. Now, virtually all the craters on the moon, we believe, are impact craters. They have raised rings. But this one doesn't. And we think it's the result of volcanism below. A pyroclastic explosion basically made a cavity about 11 kilometres across, and the surface just slumped down into it. So quite a nice thing to look at in Mare Vaporum, and I show you where it is on the night sky page. So all the very best for this month. It's a lovely time to observe the sky. Hopefully it won't be too cold. Enjoy yourselves.
Thanks for that, Ian. And for the southern night sky, here's John Field.
Kia ora and welcome to the February Jodcast coming from Wellington, New Zealand. February finds the planets Venus and Jupiter still in our evening sky. Venus is now very low down in the west, setting soon after sunset, whilst Jupiter is in the northwest and will set before midnight. Mars will rise in the northeast after twilight, appearing as a bright reddish-coloured star. Using a pair of 7x50 or 10x50 binoculars is a great way to look and discover a large number of objects in the night sky. The wide field of view is great for observing star clusters, nebulae and well-separated double stars. There are also a number of galaxies that can be found in binoculars. You can even use them for daytime viewing, as they will show an upright image compared to a telescope. Binoculars are lighter and can be used either with a tripod using an adapter or by holding them in your hands. Hand-holding binoculars, though, can be tiring on the arms and neck as well as deliver a shaky image. One way to overcome this is by using an adjustable sun lounger. Point the sun lounger in the direction that you wish to observe and adjust the angle of the lounger so your head is supported. This means that you will need only to point the binoculars in the direction of your objects. The weight of the binoculars is supported by the sun lounger. A pillow behind the neck will add to the comfort. And our evening sky, Sirius, the brightest star in our night sky, sits high in the north. It marks the front of the constellation of Canis Major, the large dog. Lower down towards the northern horizon, we find Procyon, the eighth brightest star in the night sky, and the brightest star in the constellation of Canis Major, the little dog. These two dogs are the faithful hunting companions of Orion, our summer constellation. Sitting between the two dogs is the constellation of Monoceros, the unicorn. This constellation honors a mythical horned horse. There is no myth or story associated with this constellation, as it was introduced in the 1500s. Although the shape of the horse may be difficult to discern, there are a great number of sights in the horse worth tracking down. Alpha Monoceros is a magnitude 3.9 orange star. In 1781, William Herschel discovered that Beta Monoceros is a beautiful white triple star, describing it as one of the most beautiful sights in the heavens. Small telescopes should easily separate the three components of magnitude 4.5, 5.2 and 5.6 on a good night. They form a curving arc of blue-white stars, the faintest two being closest together. Gamma Monoceros is a blue-white star and has a wide, unrelated, unaided eye companion of magnitude 5.5. Epsilon Monoceros is an easy double star for small telescopes. It consists of a yellow and blue components of magnitude 4.3 and 6. Sitting on the edge of the Milky Way, Monoceros has a large number of star clusters visible. A further way along the longitude from Sirius to Procyon is a large, splendid open cluster of about 100 stars, visible in binoculars and known as M50. Many of the stars in the cluster are pairs, triplets and in small groups. A bright orange star can be found close to the centre of the group. To the northeast of Beta is NGC 2232, a scattered irregular open cluster surrounding the fifth magnitude blue-white star 10 Monoceros. Perhaps the most famous star cluster of Monoceros is NGC 2244, which is a bright scattered cluster around which is a large faint band of luminosity known as the Rosette Nebula, NGC 2237/46. The cluster is visible in binoculars or small telescopes and forms a rectangular shape. Large apertures or an O3 filter are needed to easily see the Rosette Nebula. NGC 2261 is a fan-shaped nebula known as Hubble's Variable Nebula and a target for larger telescopes. It is a variable star at the apex. Changes in its appearance have been observed for over 100 years. These are partly caused by the variability of the star, which varies in brightness from magnitudes 9.5 to 12. NGC 2301 is a bright open cluster in a beautiful field and is well suited for binoculars or small telescopes. There is an orange star in the central region. Another interesting target is NGC 2264, which consists of a star cluster and a nebula. The cluster is visible in binoculars or small telescopes. It contains about 20 members, including a fifth magnitude star, an intensely blue-white star that is slightly variable with a close companion. This cluster is sometimes called the Christmas tree cluster due to its resemblance to the aforementioned tree. At the apex of the tree, there is a nebula known as the Cone Nebula. Its name comes from its conical shape. Unfortunately, a large telescope and dark skies are needed to observe this. Monoceros is home to one of the most massive binary star systems known. The sixth magnitude star known as Plaskett Star is a spectroscopic binary with an estimated mass of 100 times that of our Sun. Another faint object for larger telescopes is V838 Monoceros, a variable star first observed in 2002. This star underwent two periods of brightening, which is highly unusual. The star has an expanding light echo. Light is being reflected from structures inside a cloud of interstellar dust and gas. At 15th magnitude, this is a very faint object to find. Images, though, from the Hubble Space Telescope reveal a beautiful interplay of light and dust. Most stars undergo some type of variability in brightness. This may be due to orbiting planets or stars crossing in front of the star. This will make the star dim and brighten on a regular basis. Beta Persei, Algol the Demon, is one of the most celebrated variable stars in the sky. It is a system of two close stars that periodically eclipse each other every 2.8 days. The star's apparent brightness lies from magnitude 2.2 to 3.5 for a period of 10 hours before returning to maximum. Algol, when visible, is low on our northern horizon. But for those further north, it is a well worthwhile target. Other variable stars undergo a change in brightness due to internal processes, making a star swell and change in brightness and colour before cooling, and then the star returns to its original brightness and colour. These types of changes are normally associated with older red giant stars in the final stages of their lives. Betelgeuse and Orion is an example of this type of star that varies in brightness from 0.2 to 1.2, the most of any first magnitude star. Another type of variable is associated with young stars that are forming and undergoing irregular brightening. V838 may fall into this category, but there are still many questions to be answered about this star. Coming to our southern sky, we find Crux about halfway up our southeastern sky. This small but distinct constellation is well known in the southern hemisphere. Near to Crux is a group of four stars that forms the constellation of Musca the Fly. Musca is circumpolar from New Zealand, but is best viewed from February to October when it is high in our evening sky. Originally, this small constellation was called Apis the Bee, but it was redesignated in 1752 to Musca Australis, the southern fly. Since then, the Australis has been dropped, leaving this perplexed bee as a fly. Part of the Coalsack Nebula from nearby Crux strays into Musca. The fly has two globular clusters and a planetary nebula well worth tracking down along with some interesting stars. Alpha Muscae shines at magnitude 2.7 and is about 300 light years away. It is over 4,000 times brighter than our star, the Sun, and has a surface temperature of about 22,000 degrees Celsius. The majority of the star's energy is radiated away as ultraviolet radiation. Beta Muska is a double star that can be split in a 15-centimetre or greater telescope. Another double is Theta Muska, in which the brightest star is a Wolf-Rayet star. A Wolf-Rayet star is a very hot star that appears to be ejecting gas. Near to Gamma Muscae is the 8th magnitude globular cluster NGC 4372. A 6th magnitude star beside the cluster will help you to find it. Beside Delta Muscae is the 7th magnitude globular cluster NGC 4833. NGC 5189 is a 10th magnitude planetary nebula discovered by John Herschel in 1835, and he described it as a very strange object. Its appearance in a beautiful starry field is strongly reminiscent of that of the Barred Spiral Galaxy, or the letter S, leading to its popular name, the Spiral Planetary. In early February, there are two meteor showers active near the two pointer stars. Called the Centaurids, they have been known to produce fireballs up to magnitude minus 3, but the majority will be much fainter. This shower on average produces 5 meteors per hour, but increases up to 25 have occurred. Unfortunately, the peak occurs one day after full moon, and this will mean that the fainter meteors will be washed out. Remember to check out the bright northern constellations of Orion, Taurus and Gemini, as they will soon begin their gentle slide into the twilight sky. The Milky Way runs almost north-south in the evening with the constellation of Carina and the bright star Canopus overhead. This region is well worth viewing through binoculars, for there are many star clusters and nebulae to be found. From the team here at Carter Observatory, wish you clear skies and great stargazing.